Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces have liberated upwards of 6,000 square kilometers from Russian control.
In general, all the territories that have been liberated in these past days are now under very deep clearing procedure by the Ukrainian forces.
Plus, what's it going to take to rebuild Ukraine after the war?
So most of our plan is about how to organize the donors, how to bring them together, and by them, we suggest it be the G7 countries.
And later in the program, how a tragedy more than 20 years ago turned into a mission to help those in need around the world. Today is Tuesday, September 13th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that his forces have recaptured over 6,000 square kilometers that were previously under Russian control. However, intense fighting continues in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region. Now from Kyiv, Anna Chernikova joins us with more.
Ukrainian forces have already taken under control the city of Svatohirsk. It's Donetsk region, but it is very close to Izum, and this is a city was also very important in terms of its location and in terms of its historic meaning, because it has one of the biggest churches, Lavra, located in there. And Ukrainian forces have already entered this territory. In general, all the territories that have been liberated in these past days are now under very deep clearing procedure by the Ukrainian forces. And we hear that, of course, some fightings continue to happen on the border of the Donetsk region and Luhansk region. But we should not forget about Kherson region, because also heavy fightings are happening there. And as Minister of the Defense of Ukraine, Mr. Reznikov, said today that the counteroffensive actions in the Kherson region are slower than in Kharkiv region due to the specifics of the location and of the territory.
And Anna, you know, overnight, President Zelensky mentioned that because of the offensive, Ukrainian forces have reclaimed from Russian control over 6,000 square kilometers.
Yes, this is correct. President Zelensky confirmed that over 6,000 square kilometers have been liberated in general by the Ukrainian forces. So it's generally along the whole front line. And this was also confirmed by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense. If we talk about Kharkiv region, the Ministry of Defense today confirmed that the Ukrainian forces have liberated more than 300 settlements and around 3,800 square kilometers just in the Kharkiv region.
And you know, speaking of these settlements that have been liberated from Russian control, I understand you've also had some contact with some of the residents who were in the city of Izum.
Yes, there are already some contacts. Of course, they are very limited because still connection is not proper there for the moment. But what we hear from the locals and what we hear from the military, Ukrainian military who are located there, the city is at least 80% destroyed. Very bad situation with the medications and with the products. The first aid is coming already to this area, and Ukrainian local authorities are ensuring that these areas are getting both medical help and help with products and drinking water. What we also hear is that a lot of citizens of Izum have been killed. For the moment, local authorities confirmed that at least thousands of people have been killed in Izum. But again, this number unfortunately could change.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
The Kremlin said on Tuesday that there has been no discussion of a nationwide mobilization to bolster the country's military campaign in Ukraine days after a surprise Ukrainian offensive drove Russia out of almost all of the Kharkiv region. Asked about criticism of the country's leadership online by nationalist commentators who have demanded mobilization, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it was an example of pluralism, and that Russians as a whole continue to support Russian President Vladimir Putin. Military commenters, ordinarily supportive of the campaign, reacted with fury after Russia's defense ministry said on Saturday it was abandoning Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region in a regrouping after the lightning counteroffensive last week. Many suggested that only a full-scale nationwide mobilization could rectify the situation. For continuous updates on the war throughout the day, be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. Ukraine has called for more artillery and ammunition from Australia after the counteroffensive in the nation's east saw Kyiv retake a key town from Russian control. Phil Mercer has the details.
Military experts have said Ukraine needs better supplies of artillery and ammunition to hold on to key positions. Ukrainian authorities have said their forces have made important gains in recent days in pushing back Russian troops, retaking more than 3,000 square kilometers of territory. Weapons supplied by other countries have been instrumental, observers say. Officials in Kyiv have thanked Australia for its so-called Bushmaster armored personnel vehicles. They have an innovative V-shaped floor that's designed to spread the impact of explosive devices more effectively than a traditional flat floor. Ukraine wants Australia to supply up to 12 howitzers after Canberra provided 6 lightweight towed howitzers in April. Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles, who's also the Defence Minister, has described Ukraine's fight against Russia's invasion as nothing less than inspiring. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that his government will continue to support Ukraine.
Even though Ukraine is a long way from Australia, we have been standing with Ukraine as the largest non-NATO contributor to Ukraine, and will continue to provide that support in an ongoing way. And I was in Europe the week before last, and the sense that I had there, you know, in Germany and the UK and France, is that there is a similar sense of resolve about needing to stand with Ukraine throughout this time.
The biggest foreign contributor by far to Ukraine's war effort is the United States. It approved a further $675 million for weapons to Ukraine on September 9, bringing its total contribution to about $12.5 billion. Poland has committed around $1.8 billion and the United Kingdom $1.3 billion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has appealed for more international funding. He said the monthly cost of fighting the Russian invasion was about $5 billion. Australia has already sent missiles, humanitarian supplies, and imposed sanctions on hundreds of Russian politicians, military commanders, and business people. Canberra has so far spent an estimated $240 million on armaments and military support to Ukraine. Opposition lawmakers have called on Canberra to follow the United States and increase its assistance to Ukraine. Since February 2022, Australia has granted visas to almost 9,000 Ukrainian refugees. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. In a joint assessment, the government of Ukraine, the European Commission, and the World Bank all estimate that the current cost of reconstruction and recovery in Ukraine will amount to about $349 billion. VOA Ukrainian service reporter Oksana Bedratenko spoke via Skype with Bruce Stokes from the German Marshall Fund on their recommendations to the G7. She began their conversation by asking Stokes to explain his recipe for a successful reconstruction.
We believe in our report, and based on conversations we've had with people at the World Bank, the IMF, and European Union, Germany, and the U.S., that recovery has to begin while the war is still going on. That it would be much harder to rebuild Ukraine if we waited until the war was over. And that, as counterintuitive as it might be, and certainly when I've talked to average people or even some politicians about this, they say, well, how can we do this? The war's still going on. And we have to reassure them that, no, this is a better approach. And the World Bank in particular has great experience in working in war-torn countries. So we need to start now. And so most of our plan is about how to organize the donors, how to bring them together. And by them, we suggest it be the G7 countries, that it can't be just the European Union and the United States, that Japan should be involved. Hopefully we could get some of the G20 countries involved. And the other challenge is who pays what when. Right now, the United States provides the largest share of the money going into Ukraine. That's going to continue because a lot of it's military aid and because the United States has stepped up. The European Union is slowly increasing its contributions. These are unfortunately loans, not grants. What Ukraine needs is not loans, but grants. So a lot of the funding is going to be front-loaded by the United States. But we argue in our report that a lot of the funding down the road has to be from the European Union. It has to be backloaded by the European Union. Because as the process of Ukraine joining the European Union proceeds, the demands on the European Union to provide more and more money to help that process will grow. That was the history of other accession processes. This is going to be the history of this accession process.
Looking at the role which European Union should play in Ukraine's recovery, there is a lot in your report talking about more leading role in the economic recovery for the EU. And frankly, even say that EU should provide like some type of probably guarantees to the IMF, like the Greece received. That's fairly short term. Do you feel that there is a readiness and a unity in the European Union to make come up with such decisions?
Well, frankly, I'm not sure that there's even unity in the U.S. government yet about this. The U.S. government is still trying to put together its own plan of how to proceed. And one of the reasons we tried to prepare this report was to help that process. I mean, our recommendations are recommendations. It's a start of a conversation, hopefully, and it will move the process along. One of the things that we thought about and rejected, we thought, well, I mean, my initial thought was, well, we need a big pot of money. But we have a long experience now of pledging conferences where donors get together and make huge pledges for the newspaper headlines, and then they never deliver on the pledges. So we decided that it would be better to work through existing organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, where the donors would increase their commitments or their guarantees to those organizations, who could then go raise money on private markets and begin the reconstruction effort. But it's true that the European Union will have to up its commitments. There is a bit of a struggle, I understand, inside Europe about how the European Union does this. Does it incur new debt, new shared debt, which they have done now in the past around COVID relief? They've done it around climate. They've done it around military expenses. But at each juncture, the Germans and some of the Scandinavians are opposed to that because it's mutualizing debt, which they don't like.
Obviously, there is Russian money, about $300 billion were frozen in central bank accounts of Russia abroad. Do you think this money can be used to rebuild Ukraine?
Well, I know that politicians on both sides of the Atlantic want to use that money for that purpose. They don't have to ask their taxpayers to produce the money. They can just seize the Russian assets. I would say every expert we talked to about this said that they did not think this would be possible, that it would be tied up in court for years. And the idea that we would wait until we had access to that money means that the money would not be forthcoming anytime soon. What we suggested was that possibly some of that money could be part of some peace settlement, whereas part of an overall peace settlement, some of that money could be used to rebuild Ukraine. Obviously, the Russians would have to agree to that. And frankly, I haven't talked to any Russians about this, but my guess is they would not at this moment agree to that. But I do think that what we need to do is disabuse politicians that this is an easy way out, that they can somehow use this money rather than increase their own contributions. And I think that that would be a prescription for delay. And frankly, Ukraine can't wait.
So the West is obviously declaring its support and supporting Ukraine in a powerful way. What about China? What about other players who might want to participate in the Ukrainian future?
That is a great question. One never knows what will happen down the road, but it's entirely possible that the Chinese might show up in Kyiv someday and say, we can write you a check. All you have to do is use Chinese technology and Chinese workers and we'll rebuild Ukraine for you. It seems a bit fanciful today, given the closeness between Beijing and Moscow. But what we suggested was that we need to think of a way to have Chinese involvement if they are willing. One, because they have deep pockets, they can provide some of the resources that are needed. And it's better to have them inside the tent than outside the tent. There's also the issue of would some of the countries in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, some of the oil-rich countries want to play a role in helping rebuild Ukraine, providing the resources. We know already the Turks would love to be involved with their very considerable construction company presence to do that. So these are all issues that are going to have to be resolved. And frankly, I think G7 governments have to realize that there's a void here. And if the G7 governments don't step up to fill that void with resources, eventually somebody else will.
Last question. Ukraine has its chronic problems, corruption, lack of rule of law, weak democratic institutions. So what is your recipe how to overcome these problems and end up, you know, with successful EU accession?
Again, a great question. And it's a question that comes up every time you talk to people about this. And I think it's an obvious question. We try to address it straight on because I think one has to acknowledge that the anecdotal evidence of corruption in Ukraine is breathtaking in the past, before the war. And so we tried to build into our proposals oversight. History suggests that when you have massive reconstruction programs, when we reconstructed New Orleans after the hurricane, there was corruption. I mean, corruption does exist when there's that much money on the table. But we suggested that there be an ombudsman, some kind of person who was charged with oversight of making sure the money was spent fairly and correctly and honestly, that we acknowledged that the Ukrainian government has actually beefed up its own anti-corruption efforts even before this, but that as the Ukrainian government proceeds in its accession process with the EU, one of the things they might want to do is early on join the EU prosecutor's office, which would allow closer cooperation around corruption issues and help for the Ukrainian government from the EU governments in terms of the technical details of how you oversee anti-corruption efforts, how you prosecute people and pursue cases. And we think that this ombudsman, we suggested, should issue public reports on a regular basis, and that civil society can play a very important role in anti-corruption efforts by the kind of oversight that civil society can do that is actually, in many cases, more effective than simple police efforts or whatever, because average civil society members see the corruption in ways that maybe officers of the law don't.
From the German Marshall Fund, that was Bruce Stokes speaking with my colleague from the VOA Ukrainian service, Oksana Bedrytenko. On September 11, 2001, Allison Thompson was a first responder at Ground Zero. That's the site in New York City where the World Trade Center once stood. Unable to return to normal life after the tragedy, she decided to take a different direction in life. Anna Rice narrates the story to round us out.
Allison Thompson still remembers the morning of September 11th, 2001.
September 11th morning, I woke up early and I went to the TV, and it was a beautiful, bright, sunny day, and it said there was a small plane that hit the World Trade Center, and automatically I knew something was wrong.
Thompson roller skated to the scene.
I went over to it and I saw this beautiful, elegant hand, and it was an engagement ring on the finger. And it was just, I was just so stunned by this hand, and I thought there was someone behind it. So I went and just started removing some of the rubble from the hand, and then I pulled at it and it was just an arm. And I actually threw it on the ground and I just screamed. Iron worker in the back of a truck with a bullhorn. And he said, anyone with any military background, go over there. And anyone with any medical over there. So I joined the medical group. So from there on, we just lived in the streets.
She recalls how seeing people unite in the darkest hour changed something inside her, and she just knew volunteering was what she needed to do. In 2001, she founded Third Wave Volunteers, a network of first responders who support and coordinate aid during humanitarian crises, natural disasters, and other situations where people need training or resources.
In the future after that, I'd call them and I'd say, hey, there's a great tsunami that's killed 300,000 people in 13 countries. Do you want to come for a week? We can do something, you know. So they would join us. And then it would just grew and grew from there, and people joined us. So it started to grow this great army around the world, an army of love.
Along with other volunteers like her, Thompson helped people out in the Philippines, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and India. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Thompson couldn't remain indifferent.
We're in Ukraine right now, so whenever we get to those front lines, recaptured villages, we just say, hey, we love you. We start hugging them. And sometimes they hug and they try to pull out. I don't let them. I hug them and I hold them closer. And in those moments, you feel them collapse in your arms. And then that's the first time they could show emotion. And they just start crying.
In Ukraine, Thompson and other volunteers, among their other duties, train soldiers, showing them what to do if they're wounded and how to find their way in the woods. She says they train about 100 men every 4 days.
Even though it's 10 Russians to one Ukrainian on the front lines, we feel the love of the whole world. We've never felt that before until September 11th. September 11th. We had the whole world coming together for humanity, and I feel it in Ukraine.
Thompson says fear goes away quickly, and what is left is love for the people suffering and prayers that the war ends soon. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up with all the latest developments, not only in Ukraine, but on news and events around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day by visiting our website, voanews.com. On behalf of the entire team here at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.